Welcome to the Album Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Andy, Don, and Dude.
Travel with me, if you will, through space and time. It's Album Nerds Podcast. I'm Dude. I got Andy and Don with me. Gentlemen, you ready to 68?
So close, buddy. So close. Yeah, if I was going to go back in time, I think 68 would be kind of a good year to go to. Yeah. Maybe I would go there.
Sock it to me.
There you go. I think that show started in 1968.
Yeah, it was around that time.
Yeah. Very timely, gentlemen. All right. So this is the Album Nerds Podcast. We love albums, the album format, and we love talking about them. We have a great show for you today. We're each picking an album from 1968 to discuss that was a top seller. Don's going to ask us a deep question. We'll have some shout-outs to some albums and album-related items we're digging, and then we'll spin the wheel of musical discovery once again to find out what we'll talk about next time. But this week, it's all about 1968.
That's what I'm talking about!
1968 was a pivotal year in music history, marked by significant social change and cultural upheaval. Despite the tumultuous backdrop, the music scene thrived, pushing the boundaries of sound, style, and lyrical depth, creating a rich tapestry of innovation and experimentation, producing some of the most enduring and influential albums of the century. Today, each of us will present an album from the 50 top-selling albums of 1968, according to bestsellingalbums.org.
Yeah, so I mean, obviously, this was pretty easy. The hardest part was, you know, some of the best-selling albums are, of course, iconic albums that we may have talked about previously. So avoiding those was job number one. So how'd you guys do in your journeys of these albums of 1968? What'd you consider before making your final choice?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's lots of good records coming out in 68. Still kind of getting into the more of the classic album period, I would say. We're still trying to figure out exactly what that format is. One of those records that I enjoyed was from Creedence, Clearwater Revival, about their self-titled debut. It had tracks like Put a Spell on You, it's the opening cut. But the big hit was Suzy Q. It's a good record. It's, you know, it's pretty short, 30 minutes. Do you guys know what Creedence was called before they signed this contract to make this record out?
Captain Geach and the Shrimp Shack Shooters.
Oh, good guess. No, they were called the Gollywogs. You guys ever heard that before?
Golly.
The Gollywogs?
It sounds kind of familiar now that you say it, but wouldn't it come to me?
Sounds like something in a swamp.
It does. Gotta watch out for those Gollywogs. What did you find in your excursions, Dan?
Well, unfortunately, I didn't find it. So the album's called Switched on Bach by Wendy Carlos. It was number 15 on the list, but it's basically Carlos and Benjamin Folkman on a Moog synthesizer doing the music of Bach, which was pretty innovative at the time. Unfortunately, it's not available streaming. It's not available digital, like in any possible way. I'm going to have to acquire a hard copy of that. But Carlos also did the Clockwork Orange soundtrack, if you remember that. It had a lot of classical pieces, but in that sort of electronic sound. So it was pretty innovative at the time, you know, to use, you know, basically a synthesizer in a classical capacity. How about you, Dude?
Number two on the list was the Beatles' self-titled, more commonly referred to as the White Album, their ninth studio, released on November 22nd of 1968. And that could be why it was number two, because it came out late in the year.
Yeah.
And who knows who number two works for, but...
Does number two work for?
This double LP showcases the band's exploration of various musical styles. You know, they got folky, country rock, British blues, even a little ska, music hall, proto metal, and avant-garde stuff. And they all kind of wrote their own things and brought it to the table. So it was a different flavor of Beatles, but still a classic album, of course. All right, enough about all that. Let's get into our ch-ch-ch choices.
Choose me?
All right, for my top albums of 1968 selection, we're talking about Jeff Beck and his debut studio album, Truth. This came out back in July of 1968. It was the guitarist's first album since leaving the Yardbirds a couple years prior. Includes performances from many famous musicians, including Rod Stewart and Ronnie Wood, are part of the group, as well as John Paul Jones, Keith Moon, and Jimmy Page. Pretty good lineup. Mm-hmm. The record is often credited as it's helping to establish the heavy metal sound. We'll get into some details on that momentarily, but let's jump in and play the opening cut. This is a little bit of Shapes of Things. A little bit of a Beck's guitar solo from that opening cut there.
Such an amateur.
Yeah, really. Oh, step up your game there, Jeff. Well, come on.
The guitar alone takes you on this journey of thinking about the shapes of things. So that's very helpful.
That is, of course, a cover of the Yardbirds song. I read that Ron Stewart was quoted as saying he wanted to create a slowed down, dirty, and evil version of the song. And it is significantly slowed down, much less poppy sounding. And yeah, some really great influential guitar solo in there from Beck. Apparently it was inspiration for Paul McCartney's solo on Taxman. Mm. And Jimi Hendrix cited it as a reference for his style in future records as well. My clickbait headline for Jeff Beck's Truth is Beck and Co. get together to deliver what might possibly be rock's best demo tape.
Yeah, I could see that. Mm-hmm.
This is kind of an uneven record, I would say, overall. There's a lot of covers on it. Doesn't have a strong sense of personality, but I think the musicianship is just top-notch, in my opinion. In particular, Mr. Beck, but when his famous friends come on to play too, it's a pretty rousing listen at times. I think my least favorite moments are tracks like Old Man River and Greensleeves, kind of in the middle of the record there. Kind of like, I don't know, kind of throw things off a little bit for me.
Well, that reminded me, this is young Rod Stewart, but it reminds me of the stuff he's doing now when it's Rod Stewart sings the classics. Yeah. Like, that's kind of the vibe I got from it, even from his younger self.
Yeah, it pretty much feels like he's kind of in like a cover band or, doing like karaoke or something like that. There's not a lot of like personal expression happening on these tracks here, but there's moments of absolute genius. And I would say some instrumental moments, especially later on the record, do hint at some moments of like, wow, this is just really awesome. And I mean, you do hear some moments of like definite influence for music later on in the 70s. All right, let's jump in here and play the next cut on the album. This is called Let Me Love You.
A little stankier.
Mm-hmm. I guess that's why people talk about it being metal or a precursor to metal. I feel like that riff there,
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's hard blues.
Metal's hard to nail down, and it's not like something that just developed overnight. It was a slow process of these bits and pieces that ended up becoming the building blocks. And so that's why I think, I've heard the term proto-metal thrown around a lot for these.
Mm-hmm. Nope, metal began with Sabbath.
Some say Led Zeppelin. Yeah.
Well, Let Me Love You is officially credited to Jeffrey Rod, a pseudonym for Jeff Beck and Rod Stewart, and they get credit on a few of the songs here. So it's a reworking of a Buddy Guy standard with, that harder-edged rock treatment, and it's got, kind of Stewart's sort of signature raspy voice, delivering sort of, passionate, direct lyrics. My clickbait headline for Truth is Innovative Guitarist Unleashes the Rod and Gives Us Wood.
I wish I had a cheesy morning, like radio drive time show boing type of sound I could have put
right. Yeah, that'd be appropriate right now.
Yeah. Yeah, but of course this is kind of the debut of Rod Stewart and Ronnie Wood, and I wonder how music history would have changed if this core stayed together, because they all kind of went on and did different things. I agree that it's kind of an uneven album, but there is chemistry I think between these guys, and it's at some point it really works.
I just feel like Rod Stewart was kind of shackled. It feels like he's held back here.
Yeah,
like his later, like 60s, early 70s self, I think a disco beat did really well for Rod's mojo, and there's not a lot of mojo on this from him.
Nope.
Right. I think that's fair. Yeah, I would say it's a soulful performance, but I wouldn't say it's very personal or super expressive. Yeah.
Yeah, I hadn't heard this album before that I'm aware of. When I put it on, I heard Rod Stewart's voice. I'm like, sweet.
Right.
I didn't get tickled in the right spots by Rod this time.
So, you know, I guess unlike other sort of blues guitarists at the time, you have, you know, Beck using a lot of the different effects, fuzz tone and wah or wah-wah, tremolo and distortion. Probably, you know, just like, I guess he and Hendrix were probably the innovators at that time. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, definitely. I mean, I think any album that Jeff Beck is on is probably worth a listen, just because it's, you know,
I agree.
It's really interesting and can be hypnotic at times.
I think he's somewhat underrated.
Yeah, so. No, I think so too. Yeah, as a guitarist alone.
Yeah.
Well, he never ended up like in a legendary act, you know? I mean,
right.
I mean, the Yardbirds are legendary, but differently. But
yeah, but different audience. Like, I feel like this group could have been like earlier version of like Led Zeppelin or something, mm-hmm. you know, like that. Would have been had a big impact, but they never really stuck together. The stars never really seemed to align. You know?
Yeah.
Why don't we jump in here and play one of those cuts that definitely has a strong Zeppelin tie in. This is You Shook Me. You shook me all night
long. You Shook Me is a blues song originally recorded by Muddy Waters in 1962 and written by Willie Dixon and J.B. Lenoir. Or Lenoir. The Jeff Beck group was, you know, full of the guys from the Yardbirds and these kind of blues rock architects. And You Shook Me it's sleazier than the original versions. I like the what they did with the guitar. The slowed down kind of old-timey piano thing is interesting, but like it's like they took it part way mm-hmm. to being sleazy rock and roll. They pushed and then they played a little piano and uh-huh. it sanitized it a bit for me. I mean, I like the sound, but I mean, of course, in my mind, I'm comparing it to Led Zeppelin's You Shook Me from their 1969 debut album. And that one really makes it nasty, you know? And maybe this helped get that there. Maybe, you know, working with Jimmy Page and all those other guys, that's what drove that. But I feel like it was a step in the right direction. So my clickbait headline to describe the album, before Led Zeppelin, there was truth. Jeff Beck's blueprint for a hard rock future.
Wow. God said, let there be truth.
And there are moments on here that you can hear what later became Eddie Van Halen. There's like guitar things that he does that I feel like I can hear what they influenced later. And that was a pretty cool part of listening to this. That became something else, but this is where it started. And it's fun to hear. So I would say this is more bluesy than Led Zeppelin. It's, you know, more on the level blues. The guitar solos are very clean, though. Did you guys catch that where they sound very pristine?
Mm. Yeah, everything does sound very well recorded. The playing is very clean.
Yeah, like you don't hear any mistakes. I like some mistakes in my rock of this era in particular. I'm so happy I had the opportunity to dig into this record. I hadn't before, and there's so much to learn from it and so many little clues to what was to come that it's fun to go back and listen. So yeah, Jeff Beck did not get the respect that he deserved.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting little time capsule though. You definitely can hear a lot of influence and how things would grow out of this this sound. For my money, I think it really all comes to a head on track 8 there, Beck's Bolero, which features Jimmy Page and Keith Moon, who they reference or credit as You Know Who, because he was still under contractual agreement with The Who. Mm-hmm. That was kind of funny. John Paul Jones is on that track too, as well as Nicky Hopkins, who would do later work with Jeff Beck. That track in particular is just absolutely scorching. It's like only 3 minutes long, but it really does cover a lot of material. But the album as a whole, I think, is an interesting little moment in rock, and definitely kind of underscores just how talented Jeff Beck was, who I don't know if you guys realize he passed away a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, Jeff Beck debut album, Truth. Definitely a very interesting capsule of 60s rock and kind of the sounds that would come.
Before we continue our journey through time in 1968, let's hear a little bit from our friends over at Getting Down and Wordy.
Riz.
Greetings.
Gendered language.
Onomatopoeias.
The ick.
What makes some words sound funny.
Why just listen to music when you can overanalyze the words in the songs?
Music, language, and Eurovision all crammed into one podcast.
Getting down and wordy with Russell and Hannah. Whoa, whoa, whoa.
Find us anywhere you listen to podcasts.
All right, so my pick from 1968 was actually number 49 that year. It's Dionne Warwick in The Valley of the Dolls, released in March of that year. It's her ninth studio album. She was born Marie Dionne Warwick in East Orange, New Jersey in 1940. Actually, so she professionally went with the name Warwick because her first single, there was a misspelling on it. They accidentally called her Warwick, so she stuck with it. This album is produced by Burt Bacharach and Hal David, who are people she collaborated with throughout her career. Let's start with the title track. This is Theme from Valley of the Dolls. So Theme from Valley of the Dolls was written by Andre and Dori Previn for the 1967 film adaptation of Jacqueline Suzanne's novel Valley of the Dolls. So it was originally going to be recorded by Judy Garland, who was supposed to be in the film, but that was kind of when she was going through a rough time and she was let go from the film. But at the suggestion of actress Barbara Parkins, Dionne Warwick was chosen to record the song instead. The song was actually not included on the soundtrack. It is in the film, but not on the soundtrack because of, you know, record label stuff. The lyrics capture sort of a sense of being lost and searching for identity. Because this was the version that was in the film that, you know, drew a lot of people to buy the record.
Yeah, I mean, the movie was about like young ladies that went out to Hollywood to chase that dream and ended up in pain and bad relationships and drug addiction and wanting to go home. So
yeah, and actually listening to the song now, I saw the film years ago, and it does sort of capture, I think, the, you know, the essence of that movie. All right, well, my clickbait headline for Dionne Warwick in Valley of the Dolls is Bacharach and David crown Warwick the sovereign of silky vibrato. You like that?
Sovereign.
Yeah. It's not better than queen, because I always overdo the queen thing, so it's sovereign. I got a thesaurus. But yeah, she, I mean, it's interesting that her voice, I would describe it as probably smooth, but it has vibrato, you know, and so you would think that the vibrato would kind of make it not smooth.
Yeah.
She has some vocal control that just really works.
It's kind of like playing a keyboard, you know, like you get this nice, sustained, perfect tone when you hold down a key. And I feel like that's kind of what she does. There's vibrato, but the note stays the note.
Yeah, that's true.
I know. That's why I said it.
Truth.
Because I'm so insightful.
Yeah. So, you know, she doesn't do the Aretha Franklin stuff, you know, but she's still soulful in her own way.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, just a, you know, a pleasant voice that still has sort of a emotion behind it. But, you know, I mean, some of these are, you know, Bacharach compositions and, you know, they're sort of unusual, I guess, even though they're almost like pure pop. I don't know, maybe similar to like what Brian Wilson does. You know, there's, you don't even notice how maybe complex or different it is.
Because it's so saccharine on the surface.
Yeah, I guess you could say that. Yeah. All right, well, let's hear a little more. This is Do You Know the Way to San Jose?
I've got lots of friends in San Jose.
The Way to San Jose was mapped out by Burt Bacharach and Hal David. The lyrics were Hal David. I love that organ sound in there because it's so 68, and we hear it in all three of the albums we're talking about.
Yeah, we need to bring back the organ, man. That was a great sound.
So, the lyrics tell the story of a failed artist who returns to their hometown of San Jose, California. You know, and it mirrors what's going on in the film, too. Disillusionment of aspiring artists, fleeting nature of fame, all that stuff. And apparently Hal David was inspired by his own personal connection with San Jose. I grew up hearing this song. My parents must have had some kind of compilation or something of Dionne Warwick because my little sister used to sing it constantly. She's like 8 years younger than me, and she would sing, Do You Know the Way to Honey Say? I don't know where that is.
Sounds nice. Like a nice place.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it does. My clickbait headline to describe the album, Burt Bacharach's Muse Takes Hollywood, the album that defined elegant pop in 68.
It is elegant.
Truly. Bacharach apparently discovered Warwick in 1961 when she was singing backup for the Drifters. It's something I read. I think she was involved in some other singing groups as well, Don. Is that right?
Yeah, she was. She recorded with a group that her mother managed, the Drinkard Singers.
Okay. The Drinkards?
Yeah.
It was a hopefully it's the last name of Drinkard, yeah, I think not so. People who were drinking all the time. This is the first full Dionne Warwick album I've ever listened to. Is that the same for you fellas?
Yes.
Yes.
I mean, because I'm like, I remember from the 80s, like, That's What Friends Are For, and then, you know, the occasional Say a Little Prayer and that kind of thing. And she pulls it off. I mean, her voice and Burt Bacharach's charming compositions work so well together. The sweetness of the lyrics are carried well by her voice, and then the compositions are interesting enough to make it more than just, you know, pop songs. And it's a really friendly, comfortable place to hang, even though it's about kind of a depressing movie.
All right, well, let's hear another one. This is For the Rest of My Life.
The few moments on the record where Warwick really goes for it, I would say. And I for my money, I think that works really well. Mm-hmm. I was impressed.
I do too.
The song was written by Man Curtis and Flavio Carisi.
Oh, what a sweet name.
That is pretty good, isn't it?
Oh, God. I'd love to have that name. It doesn't fit. People would look at me and be like, you ain't no Flavio, dude. But it still would be fun to say.
Just to say it.
I want to be Man Curtis.
Yeah, both good names. My clickbait headline for Dionne Warwick's Valley of the Dolls is Neon Dion is at her best when her primetime producer has the rhythm high stepping.
Wow. Well, Deion Sanders references. Yeah.
It's a bit of a stretch. But my point remains the same. I think this record is at its best when Dionne and Burke are kind of like hand in hand here, like when the beat and her voice are kind of like in lockstep, which they are on many of the popular cuts here. It's really catchy and compelling and fun, and I think her voice works well with this type of arrangement around it. There's times when things maybe slow down or get a little bit more mellow where I feel like her voice gets a little bit lost in the mix, where you're like it's a little bit hard to distinguish her from some of the strings in the background.
I think it's interesting in context of 1968, this type of music, because everything was counterculture and all of that was happening in pop and rock, you know, where it was getting very psychedelic and hippy-dippy and all of that stuff. And there still was a place for this swelling orchestra, soaring voices type of stuff. And it's the best of both worlds. So then you're capturing the audiences of, say, the parents of the hippies, but then there are elements in it that are modern, and it still can play on the radio. So I think it's a bridge. Like, this kind of music was a bridge in the late 60s between the old guard and new guard.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, man. It does kind of feel like two different styles coming together here, and Warwick's kind of right in the middle of it. So, I mean, I did enjoy it overall. I think it's maybe a little bit uneven as an album, but the high moments, I think, are well worth listening to.
Yeah, another cut I liked a lot was Silent Voices, which was an English language adaptation of an Italian song called La Voce del Silenzio.
Sounds pretty good too when you say it.
But that's another one where she kind of goes for it with her voice. But yeah, overall, you know, I think a solid album. Dionne Warwick in Valley of the Dolls is a sophisticated blend of pop and soul. It marks a high point in her career in collaboration with Burt Bacharach and Hal David. Check it out.
Excuse me. I'd like to ask you a few questions.
Time again for Deep Questions by Don. So we're, of course, discussing the great music of 1968. What else was cool from that year?
There was a lot of cool stuff kind of created in 1968. Obviously, it was not around, but there was plenty of things created that I still use nowadays. The beanbag chair, apparently, was put on the market first in 68.
Beautiful.
Nice. We have a couple of those in our house. I love it. Hot Wheels.
Ooh, yeah.
Man, nice. We got some 68 Hot Wheels. That's probably worth something right now.
Yeah. America's answer to Matchbox.
All right. Is that the American version?
Yeah. Matchbox was out of England. You know, so those predated the Hot Wheels.
Oh, gotcha. As a kid, I thought that Matchbox was like some Hot Wheels ripoff. I think just because Hot Wheels was, had the track sets and all that cool stuff.
Yeah, that's what I remember most about it, was building those tracks and launching them down the stairs or whatever.
Yeah. It had then the rubber band would snap, and you'd have to find a fresh rubber band to put in the launcher thing.
Yep.
Remember that?
Launcher band. We said gravity.
I had this one that had this plastic launcher thing, and it was powered by a rubber band, and you'd pull it back.
I remember that.
Send the car flying, do the loop, the loop.
That does sound pretty cool. And one last thing I'll mention here, Pringles came out of the markets. Once you pop, you can't stop.
I can.
You didn't have the fever for the flavor of a Pringles?
No, man. I mean, it's just potato flakes with a little water mashed into shapes. Like, it's not chips.
There actually was a lawsuit at one time so they're not allowed to call them potato chips.
Right, because they
really? Yeah. I mean, they are potato. It's just, it's like bits of potato that they're sort of gluing together in the shape of a chip, whereas a real potato chip is like a sliced piece of potato.
They couldn't be uniform like that if they weren't made in a factory. But yeah, it's like, we're being baby birded potato chips. Someone chewed them up, spit them out, mashed them into circles, and now we're eating them.
Jeez, I'm never going to look at a Pringles the same again.
They're still delicious.
How about you, dude?
So I went with a movie that came out in 1968, The Odd Couple, the one starring Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau, based on the Neil Simon play. And then, of course, a TV series came later, multiple odd couple type relationships in TV shows and movies. There's so much comedy was based on this concept of the Oscar being the slob and the Felix being the clean freak and stuff.
Chris Farley and David Spade.
Well, like our friends, Monica was the Felix,
Okay.
But yeah, the movie is basically about these two guys that get divorced and they end up becoming roommates and they're total opposites from each other. And it's so funny. And Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon together later in Grumpy Old Men, the perfect foils for each other. And I love both of those guys, but Walter Matthau in particular, I just like Bad News Bears and whatever. So I feel like he got to become him because of the success of this film. So that's why I brought that one up. I just think it's a great concept and two great actors that got a lot of mileage out of that relationship.
Yeah.
How about you, Donnie? What you likey?
It's a beautiful day in the neighborhood.
Hi, neighbor.
I guess it actually existed in some form before that, but in 1968, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood debuted as sort of a nationally broadcast program on the precursor to PBS. And it was just, such an innovative, children's program. I guess I hadn't realized it at the time, but one of the cool things about it was that, he wasn't a character. He didn't do, stupid voices or anything. He just kind of talked to the kids
like people.
Yeah. And I think there was value in that.
Oh, I know. Yeah. I mean, lessons about believing in yourself and that being different is okay and you're special. And
wearing the appropriate shoes in the right room.
Yeah. Make sure not to wear your street shoes out in your fake living room. You are my friend. You are special.
The thing I like about it, too, is that, having seen, the documentaries and the biopics, he was the real deal, there's no skeleton in the closet, that we know of yet, but, there was no darkness there. It was just, he was what he was,
They didn't even find any skeletons in his sex dungeon.
Jeez, man.
No, the guy was a wonderful, caring man that wanted kids to feel good about themselves, and I think it was 100% real.
Yeah,
I used to get very mad when people would say anything hinting at anything else about Mr. Rogers being creepy in some way. I'd cut a bitch. I said something about Mr. Rogers.
All right. Well, what other cool things came from 1968? Let us know. Hit us on Instagram and Facebook, or leave a comment on our website, albumnerds.com.
Want to get high?
Time to talk about some psychedelic 1968 music. We're going with Iron Butterfly and their album, Enigata Divita. This was number one, according to the list we worked off of. Sold millions and millions of copies. It's an album largely known for the 17-minute title track that covers all of side two on the original vinyl. 17 minutes and 5 seconds. Iron Butterfly was formed in 1966, during the explosion of the psychedelic rock scene. There was a whole lineup. They made an album. They broke up chunks of them. And then the lineup on this particular album is Doug Engel, Eric Braun, Lee Dorman, and Ron Bushy. They toured with bands like The Doors, Jefferson Airplane, and Love. Got a deal with Atco Records, a subsidiary of Atlantic, and became proto-metal kings. So why don't we jump in and listen to a little bit of Enigata Divita.
Enigata Divita, honey, don't you know that I'm loving you?
Honey.
It's adding so many syllables to these words. I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, it's kind of like Creed before Creed. It reminds me a little bit of that vibe.
Mm-hmm.
There are other songs on this album, but this song is worth the price of admission alone. Is this a classic, most amazing album of all time? Probably not. But Enigata Divita, which apparently was in the Garden of Eden, but the singer was drunk when he was first singing it, and so they transcribed it wrong and liked it and stuck with it. Seems like a lot of luck fell into this. Then they were recording and started jamming, and the producers were like, oh, that sounds cool, keep it going. And then they decided to make it the whole song. And that mystique of you got to hear the whole song, and it was a 2-minute, 50-second version on the radio, is what drove people to buy the record like crazy. They had to hear this thing, you know? If you break it down a little, there's the organ intro that's very Dracula's Castle sounding. You know? Eastern-inspired patterns, which was really big at the time. Then there was that groove lock from like 140 to 3 minutes where they do this very repetitive trance-like groove, the extended instrumental jam from about the 3-minute mark to about the 12-minute mark.
Yeah.
Wah heavy guitars, drum solo from 6:30 to 9:30, which, you know, my dad was in his 20s in 1968 and lived with some other dudes, and he said that they listened to this record all the time, probably enjoying some smoky treats. And one of his buddies said that the drum solo sounded like a kangaroo stampede. That's something that they used to laugh a lot about.
That sounds terrifying, actually.
Well, you can picture that, though. A bunch of guys sitting around. One of them says, sounds like a kangaroo stampede, man.
And they all keep looking behind them. After that.
And then that climactic return, the 12-minute to 17-minute mark, and then the vocals come back in. But lyrically, it's loosely like Adam and Eve, and Adam's taking Eve on a tour of the Garden of Eden, perhaps. But because it's so open-ended, it could be a psychedelic trip through the garden, you know? And I think they bumbled into something really cool that... I hear the beginnings of Black Sabbath in this, you know, it's the very little seeds from the garden, but, you know, it's there.
Yeah.
My clickbait headline to describe Enigata Divita, 17 minutes, one riff, and a sonic lava lamp, the album that redefined psychedelic rock and kicked off proto-metal. So why don't we jump into one of the other songs from Side A? This is the opening track, I believe, Most Anything You Want. So, Andy, did this make you
I don't know how long it takes these guys to sing happy birthday. It'd be like a 17-minute song or something. Most Anything You Want is the opening cut off the record about want to make your girlfriend happy, I suppose. Good advice to the guys out
cool.
there.
Cool, cool, cool. That's what Florida Georgia Line does. Sorry.
Good callback, Don. Catchy rhythm, good guitar riff. I mean, this album has lots of guitar riffs on it, and mm-hmm. they're pretty decent. The vocals, you know, as I've been alluding to, I think are maybe the weakest part of the group. And, you know, they stretch them pretty thin. They try to get a lot out of the mileage out of what's there, and there's not a lot there.
Well, it wasn't unlike other things like the Strawberry Alarm Clock, Incense of Peppermints. There was a similar vocal style there. The Ooga Chukka, Hooked on a Feeling, that is a similar vocal treatment. It's kind of like a watered down Elvis sort of thing.
Yeah.
So it seemed like it was a common way to vocally emote in that time.
Yeah, I mean, his range is so limited, I would say. But whatever, we're here for more of the vibe, I think, that they're putting on. My clickbait headline for In the Garden of Vida is Shag Carpet and Blacklight Poster Sales Skyrocket as Iron Butterfly Ride Their One Rift into the Stoner Hall of Fame. Really, I mean, the title track there really is just, I think, seems like one riff kind of built out over 17 minutes with some different solos coming in and out.
Yeah, but somehow it's entertaining. Yeah. And also, after this is over, guys, I think we need to call a priest to be exorcised of that riff, because it is
it's very catchy,
carved into my brain. I wake up with that in my head in the middle of the night.
Yeah, right.
Please help me.
Yeah, I know. For a long song, it's like one little part gets stuck in your head. You would think one of it would maybe get in there. But yeah, I mean, the talk cut is always an enjoyable listen. I think as much meandering does go on during it, I think it's pretty satisfying when the vocals do come back in after like 15 minutes or so. But yeah, it's an interesting little collection of psychedelic rock from the era. Could do worse.
All right. Why don't we continue on this kangaroo stampede and listen to My Mirage.
In my mind I see a mirage.
I like the vocals on this song. I think it works well here.
Cool harmonies.
Yeah.
I kind of wish they stuck with the sort of the slurred, misheard lyrics. It could have been
For everything.
It could have been Mama Raj or something.
Mama Raj.
Mama. Anyway, so My Mirage was written by Doug Engel, just like I think almost all the tracks. Kind of, you know, as dude said, has some cool harmonies on it. I don't know if I believe this, but supposedly it's an homage to a pizza delivery man who was killed by a car just outside of the club where the band was performing. And like, I read that in multiple places, but I mean, the lyrics, it's like, my mirage, I'll be drawing you soon. Then all of the people that come to our home, they'll be seeing you too. Like, what the hell does that have to do with a pizza delivery guy?
Maybe it was Mirage Pizzeria or something.
Yeah, that's awesome.
All right. Well, my clickbait headline is Iron Butterfly is occasionally heavy and beautiful indeed, but it's more non-dairy creamer than cream.
Ooh.
Oh, wow. That's nice.
I say that, you know, because I keep sort of thinking that the Inagata Davida riff is similar to Sunshine of Your Love. It does sound like they're, you know, kind of trying to be creamish at times, but just sort of, yeah.
It's like a better version of it.
Yeah. But yeah, so, I mean, the name Iron Butterfly, I guess they chose because it's something that's heavy, but also beautiful. Yeah. So
I heard another thing, though, that they're playing a show, and one of the bands that was supposed to play was called The Iron Butterfly. They ended up, that band didn't show up and broke up on the way to the gig, and then the Iron Butterfly guys were like, that's a cool name, and they took it. That's the other thing I heard.
Yeah.
Wow.
Jeez. Also sounds like a military jet or something, like some code name Iron Butterfly.
Yeah,
right. Yeah, totally.
We're going to pollinate the planet.
Wow.
I don't know. Anyway, so, I mean, the album, you know, it has its moments, and, I mean, there's not much to dislike about it. You know, it's just not... It's not special, no, it's, you know, I would say.
No, but I mean, it kind of is. It's because it's so period. It's so 68. It's so over the top psychedelic that listening to it, you know, you can live in the world of Austin Powers. You know what I mean? It's
a little bit. Yeah.
it's like it's a cartoon version of 1968. Yeah. And it's great for that.
I hear a little there's kind of a Spinal Tap vibe.
Kind of. Yes. There is something. Almost feels almost made up.
Yeah,
a little bit.
The whole story.
It does feel wild to me that this is the number one selling record, like that this was so popular, like more than the White Album. Wow.
Well, again, White Album came out late in the year.
Yeah,
and right. You know, this there was this psychedelic giant opera thing, man, that you could listen to that was 17 minutes long. It was unusual. So I think it really drew that side B. Have you heard the whole version, man? Like, I can imagine those conversations going on. So yeah, 1968's Iron Butterfly. Very cool. I loved listening to this album. It was a lot of fun, and I highly recommend it to anyone that hasn't experienced that whole 17 minutes. Check out those stampeding kangaroos and enjoy.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
All right. Well, did you guys start digging anything else on your way back from the lovin'?
Yeah, I got a few things here. You can stick in the end of your rifle. Like a flower.
Oh, right. When someone wants peace. And, yeah, I got it.
Yes. The most iconic images of the era. Okay. First one up for me is Bonnie Prince Billy.
Love it.
He has a new album out called The Purple Bird. This is his 30th studio album for the singer-songwriter from Louisville, Kentucky.
30th?
30th.
Wow.
Jesus. You guys ever listen to him?
No.
I don't think so. I like the name.
Yeah. Let's hear track three. Tonight with the dogs, I'm sleeping. Howling at the moon feels like the morning. Yeah, it really takes a sharp turn towards country here, I would say. And it really works with them.
What is it normally?
It's more of like a folk rock artist, I would say.
Okay.
He dabbles in different genres, but this is the most concerted country effort I've heard from him. And I think it was probably one of the more cohesive albums I've heard from him in quite a while. Got some great backing vocals and production. Last one for me is from, I didn't realize who this actually was, artist by the name of Matt Berry. He has an album out called Heard Noises. This is his 11th studio album. He's a musician, but he's also an actor from England. He was in the IT Crowd and What We Do in the Shadows. He's like one of the main characters in What We Do in the Shadows. Let's hear track five, I Got a Limit. I am a man who
just tries to survive like a fish. He sounds a little like Glenn Campbell.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, the way they treat his voice. My track, yeah.
It's just an interesting album for sure.
Yeah, I don't really know how to classify this one. It's kind of all over the place in terms of genres and styles.
Sounded kind of British invasion-y.
Yeah, to some degree. He's from Bedfordshire, England. So.
There you go.
Yeah, Matt Berry, Heard Noises. What you been digging on down?
Well, I wasn't familiar with this group, but I started reading about them. Car Seat Headrest. They've been around a while, but they have a new album coming out May 2nd. It's a concept album or a rock opera that's supposedly based around several characters who attend a university. But yeah, so the first single is Gethsemane.
I have heard of them, but I have not heard this record.
Yeah, this is actually their 13th studio album. Originally started out, it was a solo project for a guy named Will Toledo, but they sort of embrace more of a band dynamic now.
Will Toledo sounds like a fake salesman's name. I'm Will Toledo, and I get all the best goods.
You know? Right. Well, we recently lost David Johansen, famously of the New York Dolls. So I've been kind of going down that rabbit hole, listening to a lot of Dolls and Johnny Thunders and, you know, people like that.
Buster Poindexter.
Yeah. So I've been kind of going through the David Johansen catalog, and I've really been enjoying his debut solo record, which was self-titled. Here's, you know, kind of one of his better known songs, Funky But Chic.
What's a butt cheek?
It's funky. There should be a comma in it. It's like funky but chic. But this album also features New York Dolls' Sylvain Sylvain, who also died like in the last 5 or 6 years. They're all gone, the New York Dolls, all the originals.
Oh, that's too bad.
We should honor them on a future episode.
Yes, please. All right. Well, what are you digging, dude?
Yeah, so I went with Jason Isbell, his new album, Foxes in the Snow, just came out. It's his 10th studio album, and it follows his 2024 divorce from his wife, Amanda Shires.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a solo acoustic album recorded in 5 days at New York City's Electric Lady Studios. Let's check out a little bit of Bury Me.
Bury me in the last few lines of an obituary.
Yeah, I've only listened to it 2.5 times. It's awesome, guys. Yeah. Like, I like Jason Isbell's stuff, like with the full band, but lyrically, it's very rich. I mean, I'm really digging this thing. I think it's, I'm going to ride with this one through the year. But it's 11 tracks that delve into heartbreak, growth, reflection.
Nice.
And it's been praised by critics, so we'll see. Maybe this will...
Well, divorce, you know, can lead to a lot of good music, so hopefully it works out for him.
Yeah, I think that's why artists get married in the first place. So they're like, when's this going to fall apart much, so yeah. I have something to write about?
I'm sure they both put out great records now.
All right, so the next one, recently added to my vinyl collection, Diana Ross's Diana from 1980, her 11th studio album. Why don't we jump right into Upside Down? Produced by Nile Rodgers and Bernard Edwards of the band Chic, of course.
Of course. That's kind of funky and chic. Yeah.
The album features a disco pop sound and includes, of course, I'm Coming Out as well, which is another big hit. I picked this up on vinyl this past week and happy to have it in the collection because I do have some fond memories of music from the early 80s. So,
all right. So what are you digging? Let us know. Join us on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. Also on our website, albumnerds.com.
It will be a discovery of extraordinary value.
Well, it's about that time on the show, and I'm reminded of the great American U.S. Senator and Attorney General, Robert Kennedy, who said, you guys indulge me, this is kind of a longer quote, but I thought it was very good, so take a moment here. The gross national product does not allow for our health of our children, the quality of their education, or the joy of their play. It does not include the beauty of our poetry or the strength of our marriages, the intelligence of our public debate, or the integrity of our public officials. It measures neither nor our wit nor our courage. Neither our wisdom nor our learning, neither our compassion nor our devotion to our country. It measures everything in short except that which makes life worthwhile. And it can tell us everything about America except why we are proud that we are Americans.
Jeez,
Kennedy, man. Kennedy accent there, I think, maybe would help.
Yeah, I felt like I had to put my hand on my heart like it was a Pledge of Allegiance or something. Take my hat off. Jeez.
Yeah, those Kennedys, man. They were good at the stirring speeches.
Excellent orators.
Indeed. Well, with that in mind, let's bring out my friend and yours, Wadbot, to see what we'll be talking about on next week's episode.
Music is always evolving, shaped by new influences and cross-cultural inspiration. Next time, you will be diving into albums that introduced bold styles and fresh ideas, leaving a lasting impact on both music and society.
New sounds. Cool. That should be a little more challenging than a list.
Yeah.
I'm a little sad. I'm going to have to work for this one.
Actually, do some work. Use our brains.
Somebody send us a list. What great albums demonstrated new sounds? What else are you listening to? Email us at podcast@albumnerds.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky at Album Nerds. And visit us at albumnerds.com to suggest topics for the show, peruse the Hall of Fame, and listen to all 282 episodes. And the best way to support the show is to share it. Please subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast app.
Thank you once again for joining us on the Album Nerds Podcast. We'll catch you next time with those new sounds. Oh, yeah.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Catch you next week.
Keep smiling, keep shining, knowing you can. Oh, nope.
Well, you can always count on us to make fun of you when that happens to your voice. So, ha ha.